$1 billion in compensation increases. President of the Teachers Federation, Susan Lambeau, said the union took advantage of the holiday break to revamp their proposal and hopes the school board has done the same. Official synopsis from a third-party government body says, fat chance. The BC Labor Relations Board concluded in a ruling in late December that bargaining between teachers and their employers is in such dire straits that they believe changes must be made, that the entire bargaining process is fundamentally flawed. Of course, it doesn't look like anything is going to be done to change the bargaining process quite yet, which is good to me at least. Watching teachers bicker with superintendents is almost as much fun as foxy boxing in a mud pit. But that, too, is probably fundamentally flawed.
The group that runs Insight says there is a clear need for a second supervised injection site in Vancouver. Mark Townsend from the Portland Hotel Society, that operates the North America's first supervised injection site, says with more than 12,000 registered users and 800 injections every day, the initial location in the drug-riddled Hastings Street corridor is becoming overcrowded. Townsend said that the Portland Hotel Society would have to receive approval from a number of different authorities before proceeding, including the City Council, the police, the health authority, and the provincial government, and then they would have to apply for a federal exemption to do it. Vancouver Councillor Kerry Yang said the original Insight, which opened in 2003, reduces the spread of HIV and other infections on the street and has got drug users in touch with healthcare workers. But Yang also said health authorities must determine an actual health need across the city for a second site before City Hall will back it. However, as Vancouver Coastal Health's crackpipe distribution pilot wraps up its first month, two partner agencies are reporting user demand is outstripping supply. The 60,000 pipes for the 8-month pilot means partners can only distribute 250 pipes daily to last the program, which began December 6th, and aims to monitor user demographics as part of VCH's drug harm reduction strategy. For more on this, we go to a report by Jill Bennett for the Toronto Sun.
The demand is much larger than the supply, it seems, when it comes to free crack pipe kits being handed out in Vancouver. The kits are part of a pilot project aimed at reducing the spread of disease among addicts. Our reporter, Jill Bennett, joins us live from Vancouver with more details on this project. And Jill, the project's been underway at least since last month. How well is it being received thus far?
Well, definitely, Anita, by the people who are lining up to get these kits, as you mentioned, the supply will not last the 8 months if the demand keeps up the way it's been going just since they started handing them out in December. There's five different depots in the downtown east side where addicts can go and get the kit. And the difference being these kits have pipes in them for smoking crack. They have alcohol swabs and they have different things in them. And it's the first time that the health authority has actually handed out entire kits rather than just mouthpieces for the pipes or just pipes. But there are about between 50,000 and 60,000 pipe kits for the entire project. But thousands have already been handed out. And what the people distributing them are saying is they're either going to have to bring in a quota as one pipe per day or some kind of system. Otherwise, they're going to run out before the end of this pilot project.
Jill, a lot of people are probably just scratching their heads saying, quota, schmota, well, you know, how do we even just get these people off this addiction? What are your thoughts on that in terms of the evidence that you're finding to support this project?
Well, yeah, and it's kind of the same argument as Insight, dealing with people on heroin, people taking the stance that it should just be abstinence and you should be able to get into rehab and get off the drugs, which would be great if that's the way it worked. But a lot of the health officials that are working on this project say, yeah, we would love to get everybody into rehab. And they're hoping actually the project will help with that, because when they have interactions with drug users who are coming to get the kits, they can talk to them about the other options. But the real focus of this isn't so much getting everyone off the drugs. It's keeping keeping everyone healthy so they can make it, hopefully, at 1.2 rehab and cut down the costs for taxpayers. So taxpayers aren't dealing with people flooding the emergency rooms and dealing with the spread of HIV and the spread of hepatitis B and hepatitis C, because a lot of the healthcare workers are saying, if you just look at it from a taxpayer point of view, it is a lot cheaper to give someone a crack pipe and keep them from spreading disease than it is to treat somebody who's dealing with all of these illnesses. So they will be tracking it after the 8 months to see if, in fact, a project like this, a program like this, actually does curb the spread of disease.
Absolutely. All right. We'll have to leave it there. Thanks for bringing us the latest on this, Jill.
You're welcome.
Well, our Sun News team hit the streets of Vancouver to find out what you think of the city's decision to hand out these free crack pipe kits. Take a listen.
I do agree with that there is use to help them with, you know, with the fresh, the new needle program and stuff like that. But, I mean, where is the offset in terms of additional monies going to drug treatment programs and stuff like that? I would prefer to allocate resources that way.
Well, they're going to do it anyway, so might as well give them a helping hand doing it.
This is also the focus of our daily web poll. We want to hear what you think about this.
Thanks to the Toronto Sun for that update on Insight in Vancouver. In local news, the RCMP are searching for a man after an attempted abduction attempt of a two-year-old boy in Langley this morning. The attempt occurred at 9 a.m. this morning at Douglas Park. RCMP spokeswoman Captain Holly Marks said that a father and his two-year-old son entered the playground at Douglas Crescent, and the father had turned away from his son when putting down the boy's bike and helmet. During this time, an unknown man picked up the boy and began walking away, but dropped him when he was spotted by the father and then ran away. He got into a dark green SUV with tinted rear windows and drove away. The police have described the subject as East Indian or Hispanic, height 5'9", an average build. He was wearing a white hat and a dark shirt.
It could be the largest private infrastructure project in BC history. Or the regulatory system could be hijacked by environmentalists and a gaggle of rabid radicals who want nothing more than to destroy this country and its economic values. Such is the great debate surrounding the Northern Gateway Oil Pipeline, a project that hopes to build twin pipelines to carry Alberta crude oil to Kitimat for export to Asia. The federal regulatory hearings start tomorrow in Kitimat, and with the U.S. government's decision to delay by at least 1 year the Keystone XL pipeline project, all eyes are on Kitimat. There doesn't seem to be any shortage of spectators. More than 4,000 people and groups have signed up to speak at the hearings, which will be conducted by two federal environmental bodies over the next 18 months. And if today's news is any indication, we can expect plenty of senseless bickering from both sides of the argument. Today, Joe Oliver, Canada's Minister of Natural Resources, published an open letter on the MarketWatch page of the Wall Street Journal. The letter is basically a plug for the $5.5 billion project. Oliver claims the construction of these pipelines is an urgent matter of Canada's national interest, and he goes on to blast environmental and other radical groups that seek to block this opportunity to diversify our trade. On the flip side, people like Eric Swanson of Dogwood Initiative, a Victoria-based group that opposes oil tankers on the West Coast, takes issue with the claim that the Northern Gateway Pipeline is in our national interest, saying that it isn't a nation-building project, it's a nation-dividing project. Fighting beside Swanson and other radical environmentalists are over 60 BC Aboriginal communities, vowing to fight the project every step of the way. According to the Minister of Natural Resources, these groups are threatening to hijack our regulatory system to achieve their radical ideological agenda, exploiting any loophole they can find and stacking public hearings with bodies to ensure that delays kill good projects. Oliver ended his pleading letter to the Canadian people, published through an American newspaper, with calls to overhaul our regulatory system to help this pipeline thing move along a little more smoothly. So basically, this boils down to two differing points of view, particularly with regards to where our priorities lie: jobs or the environment. It's said that the Northern Gateway project would add about $270 billion to Canadian gross domestic product and create almost 1,200 full-time jobs in BC and Alberta. But is the risk of an environmental catastrophe on the West Coast a justifiable means for more oil money? These are questions the Federal Regulatory Committee will hope to answer. The hearings will start in Kitimat at 9 a.m. tomorrow morning and will continue to hold similar hearings over the next few months throughout BC and Alberta.
Well, those are your local headlines. Up next, we have a weather update brought to you by Phil from the Storm Club.
Thank you, CJ, and good evening, listeners. Rainy weekend, cloudy morning, and more cloud cover this evening. Some of you out there must be wondering whether the sun will ever shine again. Well, those of you are in luck. Starting tomorrow, thanks to a passing high-pressure cell in our region, we're expecting to see sunshine persist for the next 2 days, with 0% chance of precipitation. But remember to still dress warmly, as temperatures will still be lingering between a chilly 0 and 5 degrees Celsius. Now here's your weekly 7-day long-term forecast for UBC. Tonight, mainly cloudy, clearing up near midnight with patches of fog. High of plus 2, low of 0. Tuesday, sunny with some clouds. High of 6, low of 4. Wednesday, sunny with patches of cloud. High of 4, low of minus 1. Thursday, we have a cloudy overcast. High of 5, low of 0. Friday, we are expecting to see some showers. High of 7, low of 2. Saturday, cloudy with a 60% chance of showers. High of 7, low of 2. Sunday, also with 60% chance of precipitation. High of 6, low of 2. Currently, it is 9 degrees Celsius here on campus. Historically, around this time, it is between 0 and 6 degrees at this time of the year. That's your weather for this week. Brought to you by the UBC Storm Club. For News 101, I'm Phil Chang.
Thank you, Phil, for that weather update. We're going to take a quick break, but stay with us. You're listening to News 101 here on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting live from the University of British Columbia in Vancouver.
The 2012 UBC Student Leadership Conference, or SLC, is taking place this Saturday, January 14th. The theme for this year's conference is Breakthrough. The conference will focus on identifying obstacles, then equipping you with the tools and inspiration to break through to achieve your goals. There will be inspirational speakers, workshops on everything from time management to international service learning, involvement opportunities, and a chance to meet student leaders from across the campus. The keynote speakers this year are spoken word artist Sarah Kay, as well as the best-selling author Neil Pasricha, who wrote The Book of Awesome. Check out slc.ubc.ca to see all the content, enter contests, and to register to attend. Hope to see you there Saturday, January 14th.
Welcome back to News 101. I'm Martin Lemlin.
And I'm Chirag Mahajan. You're listening to us on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting live from the University of British Columbia in Vancouver, or online at citr.ca. Thank you for being with us. It's now time for the national news.
The New Democratic Party of Canada are poised to find a new candidate to replace Jack Layton tonight in Toronto. After his unfortunate death last August, Layton's passing left both the NDP leadership and his Toronto Danforth House seat open. The party mechanics are already chugging along to elect a new leader in March, but tonight, the New Democrats will choose a successor who will try to retain Layton's seat in Parliament. There are the three nominees: Craig Scott, a law professor specializing in human rights; Justin Duncan, a lawyer and environmentalist; and Claire Prashaw, a teacher and community activist who's worked in international development in Latin America. Since the Toronto Danforth seat is now vacant, a by-election must be held. It has to be called by Stephen Harper, who has until February 22nd to announce a date. Whoever wins tonight will represent the NDP in the upcoming by-election. Now, the riding itself is located east of downtown Toronto and represents a diverse section of the city, including large Chinese, Greek, and South Asian communities, whose support is key for the NDP if they are to hold on to the seat.
The HMCS Charlottetown, or Halifax class frigate, has served the Royal Canadian Navy since 1995, left a Navy dockyard in Halifax yesterday. The ship will participate in the NATO-led Operation Active Endeavour, tasked with finding and boarding ships suspected of participating in terrorism. The specific mission is called Operation Metric. Charlottetown Commander Wade Carter, who will have a crew of about 250 sailors, stated yesterday that, quote, "We'll join NATO and we'll be part of a counterterrorism mission, which effectively means we're going to be patrolling the Mediterranean, looking for weapons of mass destruction or constituents that that could be used to design such things, end quote. Although the ship's purpose is said to be exclusively counter-terrorist at this point, it seems as though its mission could be quite another, as Iran recently test-fired a number of short- and long-range missiles as part of a 10-day naval exercise in the Strait of Hormuz, a vital Persian Gulf waterway used by tankers carrying one-sixth of the world's oil supply. Quote, I don't think NATO has any specific intention or direction at this point to deploy forces to the Strait of Hormuz either, end quote, said Commander Carter. Though he also said that the Charlottetown and its crew are more than capable of moving from the Mediterranean Sea through the Suez Canal and the Red Sea to the Arabian Sea and the Strait of Hormuz area if they're called to help.
The federal liberals have a big week ahead of them as they continue to piece together the shattered remnants of their prized party. This Friday, thousands of liberals will converge on Ottawa for the party's biennial policy convention, where they will elect a new party president, hold strategy sessions, and vote on a wide range of policy resolutions. But first, Liberal MPs and senators will gather on the Hill Wednesday for a two-day winter caucus meeting to plan their agenda for when Parliament resumes on the 30th. In preparation for the convention, the party's National Board of Directors put together a plan that lays out how the Liberals need to revamp the party on almost every level. Of course, since this is Canadian politics, the event is likely to be one of the dullest, inane affairs conceived by modern man. But there's also a chance for groundbreaking ideas and interesting conversations. The Liberals are in a position that could be advantageous. Since their historically rich party was beaten beyond recognition, almost to the point of obliteration in May, they're forced to overhaul the way it operates. If they make dramatic changes in the right places, they could pique the interest of millions of Canadians who don't even bother to vote at all. For the convention this weekend, delegates chose 10 resolutions that will go straight to the plenary sessions. These priority resolutions include a national food strategy, a national high-speed rail system, a housing strategy, but among the more interesting topics are the legalization and regulation of marijuana, and amnesty for Canadians currently convicted of simple possession, also switching to a preferential voting system that requires 50% plus one vote to win a federal riding, as opposed to our first-past-the-post system that we currently have, and, courtesy of the party's youth wing, severing ties with the British monarchy and introducing a Canadian head of state. These are questions that no other major federal party is publicly discussing, which gives the Liberals a chance to lead political reform in this country. It's a test to see just how deep their willingness to change goes.
Well, those are your national headlines. You're listening to News 101 here on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting live from the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. I'm Chirag Mahajan.
And I'm Martin Lumlin.
Thank you for being with us. It's now time for the international news.
Oh, yes. The international news.
U.S. President Barack Obama's chief of staff, William Daley, will resign just 1 year into his rocky tenure at the end of this month. It was confirmed today. Although Daley's political duties has been diminishing since mid-November, it was not expected that he would leave until after the presidential elections next November. Daley will be returning to Chicago, as he indicated in a letter to the president that was obtained by the Los Angeles Times. In it, he says, quote, I have been honored to be a small part of your administration. It is time for me to go back to the city that I love, end quote. Daley will be replaced by White House veteran and former Clinton budget director, Jacob Liu. He was also a senior advisor to late Speaker Tip O'Neill and is the administration's current budget director. This is Obama's third chief of staff.
Over the past 48 hours, news has broken in India of the existence of at least 12 patients infected with tuberculosis that has become resistant to all the drugs used against the disease. Physicians in Mumbai are calling the strain TDR for totally drug resistant. In other words, it is untreatable as far as they know. News of some of the cases was published on December 21st in a letter to the journal called Clinical Infectious Disease. The letter describes the discovery and treatment of 4 cases of totally drug-resistant tuberculosis since last October. On Saturday, the Times of India disclosed that there are actually 12 known cases just in one hospital. the PD Hinduja National Hospital and Medical Research Center. And since most hospitals in cities across India do not have the facilities to identify this new TDR strain, it is more likely that unrecognized cases can go on to infect others. Health authorities estimate that one patient with active tuberculosis can infect up to 15 others. The reason this is bad news is because tuberculosis is already one of the world's worst killers, up there with malaria and HIV/AIDS, accounting for 9.4 million cases and 1.7 million deaths in 2009, according to the WHO. In India alone, there are more than 1,000 people die of this disease every day, not a laughing matter at all.
According to a report compiled by monitoring groups, diplomats, lawmakers, and analysts, tens of millions of dollars in diamond profits are being secretly extracted from state-owned mines in eastern Zimbabwe, bypassing the nation's treasury and raising fears that President Robert Mugabe is amassing wealth to extend his 31-year reign. Even if Mr. Mugabe's allies in the mining ministry, are telling the truth about the number of diamonds produced, the treasury was still shortchanged by at least $60 million last year, according to a budget report by the finance minister, one of the president's chief opponents. Now that Mr. Mugabe no longer controls the finance ministry, the result of a tenuous power-sharing arrangement to end the rampant state-sponsored violence during the 2008 presidential election, analysts say he needs outside income to finance his political operations. Diamonds offer him a rare opportunity to do that, especially now that international monitors have agreed to let Zimbabwe sell vast quantities of them, despite repeated warnings that it would enable Mr. Mugabe to tighten his grip on the nation.
Yemen's cabinet has approved a law granting President Ali Abdullah Saleh and anyone who has worked under him immunity from prosecution for any crimes committed during his 33-year rule. Sunday's decision came as a surprise to many in Yemen, who believe that a power transfer deal he signed in November granted him and his family immunity from prosecution for the killing of the protesters, but would not extend to cover his 33-year rule and anyone who worked in government. The cabinet approved the law despite nationwide daily protests demanding the longtime leader be put on trial for the killing of hundreds of people in raids on protest camps, the use of snipers and armed attacks on marches during the country's 11-month popular uprising. Activists say that the country's revolutionary guards, run by Saleh's son, are responsible for most of the attacks on protesters.
The U.S. and Israel are planning a massive military exercise in the Persian Gulf at the same time as Iran prepares for new Navy drills in the Strait of Hormuz. The United Kingdom also said this Saturday that it also plans to send a warship to the Persian Gulf. In the past 2 weeks, both U.S. and British defense officials have denounced any move by Iran to close the strait, the only outlet from the Persian Gulf and a key trade route for oil. Around 17 million barrels of oil pass through the strait every day in 2011, according to the U.S. Energy Information Agency. For more on these announced military exercises, we go to Russia Today, who spoke with their correspondent, Paula Scheer, from Jerusalem.
That's still to come for you. But first, the U.S. is moving thousands of its troops to Israel for a planned joint exercise. It comes against the backdrop of increasing tensions in the Persian Gulf over Iran's threat to block the crucial Hormuz Strait. Some analysts have voiced fears it could be part of a build-up to a military strike on Iran. Well, for further details, let's join our correspondent, Paula Scheer. She is in Jerusalem. So these latest movements, should they be cause for concern?
Well, certainly people here are concerned by the latest developments. They come at a particularly sensitive time in the region as the American President Barack Obama has signed into law sanctions that will make it very difficult for countries to buy oil from Iran. Now, what we're hearing from the Israeli military is that it will reportedly be holding its biggest military drill ever with the United States. And what's important to note is that we're not talking here of only a military exercise. We're talking about the deployment of thousands of American troops into to Israel. What we're hearing from both sides is that they will be testing various missile systems against rockets and against missiles. What we're hearing, though, from the Iranian officials is that they believe that this is the latest and most blatant sign that Israel is planning to attack Iran and attack it sometime soon. The Israelis, of course, denying this. Their announcement comes just 10 days after the Iranians held a military exercise near the crucial Strait of Hormuz. But the Israelis say that this announcement that they'll be holding this joint exercise with the Americans is unrelated to the Iranian exercise.
But nevertheless, it does seem pretty serious when you do set it against the context of what's happening there in the Persian Gulf. Can you bring us up to date on what's the latest from there at the moment, Paula?
Well, tensions certainly are running high here in the region. What we're hearing from Tehran is that they believe that the European Union is waging an economic war against it. And this is in light of the EU considering imposing sanctions against Iranian oil exports. And indeed, if this goes ahead, it could be implemented by the end of January. What we're hearing from Iran is a threat that they, in turn, will close and block the oil trade through the crucial Hormuz Strait. And they've also warned the American naval presence in and around the Persian Gulf. Certainly, Tehran is feeling the pinch of the sanctions that the international community has imposed and looking to impose against it. The Iranian currency dropped to a record low after the American president signed into law those sanctions. So what we're hearing from Iran is also that it's preparing its own naval exercises, that these exercises will go ahead soon. They're part of a series that has been dubbed the Great Prophet. So certainly that has people both here in the region and in the international community concerned.
Paula, thanks very much indeed. That's Paula Slier live there in Jerusalem.
Thank you to Russia Today for that interview with Paula Slier from Jerusalem. In other international news, it's time to get down and dirty in American politics. That's right, our southerly neighbors are over 10 long months away from an election, which means things are really starting to heat up. Republican candidates are desperately clawing for leverage in the pits for a chance to carry the party's colors in November, but first they have to run through the gauntlet of primaries and caucuses. Tomorrow, the good people of New Hampshire will cast their ballots, and while Mitt Romney remains the frontrunner, his once formidable lead appears to be slipping. In the latest release of the 7 News Suffolk University tracking poll, 33% of likely voters said they will or are leaning towards voting for Romney, down 10% from last week. While Ron Paul is nipping at his heels with 20%, but it might be worth tracking Rick Santorum, who vaulted out of obscurity, almost stealing last week's Iowa caucus from Romney, coming just 8 votes shy of the frontrunner. To help us better understand the political climate in New Hampshire, we'll lean on Newsy for a bit of help.
With back-to-back debates this weekend, just days before the New Hampshire primary, GOP presidential candidates quit playing nice. According to ABC, during Saturday night's debate, Texas Governor Rick Perry sparked a response from more than 5,000 people on Twitter with his remarks on the war in Iraq.
I would send troops back into Iraq because I will tell you, I think we start talking with the Iraqi individuals there. The idea that we allow the Iranians to come back into Iraq and take over that country with all of the treasure, both in blood and money, that we have spent in Iraq, because this president wants to kowtow to his liberal leftist base and move out those men and women.
Although Perry's comments on the war attracted attention, Fox News says overall the debate lacked heat when compared to Sunday morning's NBC News Facebook debate.
Last night's exchange was pretty tame in comparison. We thought that Mitt Romney might become the pincushion last night. That didn't happen. So this morning it seems like any digs the other candidates missed out on, they got him in this morning.
For weeks, it's been Romney's star that shined brightest in New Hampshire. But as Politico reports, Sunday morning, the GOP's 4 other candidates gave him a run for his money. Even the mild-mannered Huntsman went out of his way to seek out a moment of contrast with Romney. Yet, if Romney was pushed back on his heels once or twice, there was no sign in the debate of the kind of crushing, self-destructive moment that's likely to prompt a major shift of momentum in the race. During the debate, Newt Gingrich targeted Romney's former policies, citing them as decidedly familiar, and positioned himself as the best competition to run against Obama.
And I think that a bold Reagan conservative with a very strong economic plan is a lot more likely to succeed in that campaign than a relatively timid Massachusetts moderate who even the Wall Street Journal said had an economic plan so timid it resembled Obama.
Gay rights was another hot topic in the debates. Romney stood by his comments as governor to stand up for equal rights, while the often criticized Santorum sidestepped the question.
When's the last time you stood up and spoke out for increasing gay rights?
Right now. I would be a voice in speaking out for making sure that every person in America, gay or straight, is treated with respect and dignity.
Candidates also discussed the nasty attack ads of the past few weeks. During the debate, Gingrich confronted Romney about a few.
I wish you would calmly and directly state it is your former staff running the PAC, it is your millionaire friends giving to the PAC, and you know some of the ads aren't true. Just say that, straightforward.
Well, of course it's former staff of mine, and of course they're people who support me. They wouldn't be putting money into a PAC that supports me if they were people who support me. And with regards to their ads, I haven't seen...
The morning debate did have its lighter moments. Perry made a point to correct his now famous flub.
What are the three areas that you would make some reductions that people would feel some pain? And I will tell you, it would be those bureaucrats at the Department of Commerce and Energy and Education that we're going to do away with. That's your final answer.
Although Romney seemed to be the punching bag in Sunday's debate, The Hill reports if he was bothered by the attacks, he didn't show it. Romney shirked the fire of his rivals with confidence and a cool composition, his feathers seemingly unruffled. But the sharp and meticulous attacks of his opponents, most notably Gingrich, Huntsman, and Rick Santorum, allowed them to make plain that whatever the outcome in New Hampshire, the fight is not over. Although the debate was a chance for the candidates to shore up their supporters, a writer for Policy Mike says conservative voters are still very unsure which of the Republican candidates best fits the bill. Voters are being asked to choose between extreme social, economic, and foreign policy agendas or platforms that very much tend to lean to the left. There is no pure conservative among the pack who stands a chance at winning. Ready or not, New Hampshire voters will head to the polls to cast their ballots for the GOP nominee on Tuesday. For Newsy, I'm Victoria Craig. Multiple sources, the real story.
Thanks to
Newsy. Aim at.
Thanks to Newsy for that Republican primary update. And now, as we've been talking earlier in the show, the Enbridge Pipeline public hearings begin tomorrow, and for more on that, we're going to Michael Byers, the Canada Research Chair in Global Politics and International Law. Hello, Michael.
Hello.
Hi, thanks for joining us.
Oh, it's very good to be here. Thank you.
So the first thing that I'd like to ask you is just to lay it out for people who might not know as much about the Northern Gateway Pipeline project. Who stands to benefit from the proposed project?
Well, the largest beneficiaries of the proposed project would be foreign oil companies, which are seeking to expand the development of the tar sands in northern Alberta. And as they expand their projects and develop new projects, are looking for new ways to take their product to market. And with the United States becoming increasingly concerned about the heavy carbon footprint of bitumen from northern Alberta, these companies are starting to think they need to find another buyer, and they're looking to China as a country that needs more and more oil and isn't particularly concerned about the environmental consequences. So they want to build a pipeline from northern Alberta to the coast of British Columbia through some of the most pristine ecosystems in Canada, and then ship this heavy oil out by tanker across the Pacific. And then what they also want to do is to build a second pipeline going back to Alberta that will carry gas condensate, essentially a light oil that is needed to dilute the bitumen so that it will actually flow through the pipeline going back to the coast of BC.
So this raises all sorts of environmental concerns. Do you think that, how do you think BCers feel about it? Is it it seems like this benefits China quite a bit, Chinese companies at least, and Alberta. But it is said that it will create jobs in BC as well. But it's not clear how well the benefits might be less for BC. How do you think people feel about it in BC?
Well, it will create a couple of thousand construction jobs in northern BC, and then potentially create more jobs in the future, cleaning up oil spills along the length of the pipeline, and perhaps along the length of the BC coast. Although I don't think those are the kinds of jobs that we want, particularly when there are other jobs like in the tourism industry or the fishing industry that might be put at peril as a result of this project. So yes, you're absolutely right. The main beneficiaries will be foreign companies and the government of Alberta, because it is charging some royalties on this increased development at Fort McMurray. Very little benefit for BC.
So, I guess you probably don't agree with what Federal Natural Resource Minister Joe Oliver had to say today about how the public hearings were going to be hijacked by environmental radicals.
Yeah, I find his comments very strange, because I thought that we should celebrate the fact that more than 4,000 people signed up to participate in these public hearings, the key word being public. They're exercising their democratic rights to engage in this environmental assessment process. So to criticize them and suggest that they're funded by foreign sources and that somehow undermines their credibility as Canadian citizens, I think is offensive. This is a process that is designed to provide an opportunity for all voices to be heard, and the careful determination as to whether this project makes sense both economically and environmentally. I don't want to prejudge the conclusions of that process, and I don't think that the Canadian government should do so either.
And you also mentioned, so there are lots of environmental concerns, a lot about offshore oil tankers. You made kind of a passing comment about cleaning up future spills. Enbridge maintains that, you know, the pipeline is very safe, and that the technology now is that they will ensure that they don't have spills. What do you think the likelihood is of an oil spill?
Enbridge has dozens of spills each year along its pipeline system, including a fairly major one in the United States just a few months ago.
Is this Kalamazoo?
Yeah, at Kalamazoo, the Kalamazoo River. This is a consequence of building oil pipelines, particularly pipelines for bitumen, which is a highly corrosive form of oil, and needs to be piped under fairly high pressure because it's so thick. So no, they can't promise that there won't be any spills. There will be spills. They operate in a business context that allows for spills to occur, and we need to decide as British Columbians whether we want to accept that spills will occur in places like the Spirit Bear habitat in the Great Bear Rainforest of northern BC. And the other question which needs to be factored into this are the views of the First Nations who live along the path of the proposed pipeline and along the northern BC coast, and a coalition of those First Nations, more than 60 of them, have united in opposition to this pipeline. There's a duty to consult under the Canadian Constitution with First Nations, and consulting implies that voices actually matter, the voices of those being consulted, the First Nations. So I don't actually see how this pipeline can ever be built unless Enbridge and the Canadian government can come up with some more persuasive arguments that we haven't heard yet, because nothing so far makes any kind of environmental or First Nation sense.
Mm-hmm. This brings up a lot of questions, and we've got a few people here in studio, so I think CJ is actually going to go ahead and ask you something.
Yes, hello, Michael. I was wondering, when you spoke of the consultation process, could you tell us a bit about how that works? Are there any government representatives who go with Enbridge to the First Nations communities, or is it just Enbridge representatives who speak with them?
No, the consultative process is one that's set up by the National Energy Board. So it's a federally appointed agency that is required to engage in this kind of consultation, and opens an invitation for people to sign up. And in most cases, the numbers are in the hundreds. In the case of this particular pipeline, the numbers are in the thousands. And Enbridge talks about negotiating with First Nations, but is having a distinct lack of success in persuading First Nations that this project is a good thing.
So is it reasonable to have some concern about the kind of the transparency of information being given to the communities themselves? I mean, is Enbridge open about concerns about spills or possible disruptions to the pipelines?
Well, this is why I think it's important to have a process that allows a full range of expert advice to be provided, including
right.
those of environmental groups. Certainly, the First Nations, many of their leaders are very savvy people who are perfectly capable of assessing the facts and making their own decisions. And this process, which will continue for a couple of years, will enable them to do so. But many of them, as I said, have already looked at this carefully and come to the conclusion that they don't want this project. And I think that matters. We have duties to First Nations, and in this province, many of our First Nations do not have treaties, so they actually have rights that are vested in their original Aboriginal title, which is a very powerful thing that will, in my view, stand up to judicial scrutiny if this eventually ends up in the courts, which it will if the Canadian government continues to press hard for this project.
I'm wondering, you also have looked into the Keystone pipeline as well, right?
Yes, I have, I wrote a piece for Salon.com a few months ago, just before the Keystone decision was made by President Obama, simply to point out that the Canadian government, in arguing that, if the Americans won't buy our oil, we'll just ship it to the west coast of BC, that argument wasn't quite as much of a threat as the Canadian government was suggesting it was, because of the fact of the First Nations opposition and also the opposition of many people in British Columbia to this project. This is not a done deal. And I was pleased to see that the President Obama decided to postpone his decision on Keystone XL, this proposed pipeline from the tar sands to the American coast of the Gulf of Mexico, while a full environmental review was taking place there. And this is also, and one mustn't lose sight of this, this is also an issue of climate change. The carbon footprint of bitumen from the tar sands is disproportionately large. It's the largest industrial project on the face of planet Earth right now, the development of the tar sands. And Canada cannot develop the tar sands, as the government of Canada is planning to do, and play any kind of role as a constructive partner in the fight against climate change. So this is part of the picture, too. And transporting this heavy oil to foreign markets is therefore not just an issue of possibly creating jobs, but it also has an impact on our long-term environmental and economic future, because climate change in and of itself will place a huge economic burden on future generations.
Obama has sort of been accused of playing politics with this. Do you think that an environmental review will actually change the decision of the government here or in the U.S.?
Well, yes, Barack Obama is playing politics because he's in an election year, and Stephen Harper apparently doesn't need to play politics because he's not in an election year. So, you know, how do you analyze this beyond the question of just good policy making? I think one has to look behind the headlines and understand where these people are coming from in terms of their core values. President Obama has expressed serious concerns about climate change in the past. He's a really smart guy. He understands the science. He takes a full range of advice from scientific experts. Stephen Harper, on the other hand, doesn't have much interest in science at all. He's the son of an oil company executive, and his political base is in Calgary, which is at the very heart of the oil industry. So they come from very different places. And it just so happens that here in BC, where many people, very many people, are concerned about the environment, we're represented by a prime minister who comes from a very different political culture and mindset, who simply regards the oil that's in that sand as something that is worthless unless we do something with it, i.e. export it so that it can be burned elsewhere.
Mm-hmm. Well, I just wanted to go back a bit to the transportation of the oil. Do you think there's no doubt that the number of oil tankers in BC waters will now increase? I mean, will increase eventually when if the pipeline is built?
Well, there are no tankers servicing the north coast of BC at the moment. There's a de facto moratorium on oil traffic there. And so the only way that, this oil could get from the pipeline to China would be to introduce oil tanker traffic in very significant numbers along that very pristine and dangerous coast. It's a dangerous coast because there's some pretty extreme weather there. It's a very rocky coastline, and accessing Kitimat requires bypassing some rather narrow channels and working between islands. And your listeners will remember how the Queen of the North, the BC Ferry, ran aground there just a couple of years ago with two lives being lost. This is not going to be safe. Obviously, you know, if you believe in having an economy, you have to do some things, like generate energy. But I think if one looked at the larger picture and internalized all the external costs associated with this heavy oil and this pipeline and these tankers, you could make a very easy case for taking the money that would be invested there and putting it into other alternative energy sources instead.
Okay, well, thank you so much for talking to us today.
Well, we'll be talking about this pipeline for at least the next 2 years. And, thank you very much for starting the conversation.
Yeah, we look forward to this conversation from the public hearings and the public getting involved. So thank you. Thank you for giving people a taste of what's to come.
You're most welcome. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Well, that was...
That was Michael Byers from UBC, actually, who was speaking to us from Salt Spring. And he is the Canada Research Chair in Global Politics and International Law. And he is also a journalist and an author. And so we spoke to him about the Northern Gateway Enbridge Pipeline proposal. And public hearings begin in Kitimat, BC tomorrow.
Great. So those were your provincial and international headlines. We're going to take a quick break, but stay with us. You're listening to News 101 here on CITR 101.9 FM.
Want to know what's up at UBC? Read the UBC. It's only the largest student newspaper in Western Canada, and it's written and edited entirely by UBC students. The UBC is your source for on-campus news, culture, and sports. New editions come out every Monday and Thursday. For breaking news as well as amazing videos and blogs, check out ubc.ca.
The alphabet has only 26 letters. With these 26 magic symbols, however, millions of words are written every day.
Pick up your winter issue of Discorder, as the Jan-Sember issue is packed with goodies that will warm even the coldest of cockles. Take a dip with Dixie's Death Pool, a spacey art rock collective, or read up on local outsider pop music makers, World Club. Cozy up on the couch with Filmstripped, featuring a review of Color Me Obsessed, a documentary on The Replacements. And in case you missed the memo, 2012 is almost here. Check out the Discorder album picks of 2011. Don't forget to pick up your special Jan-Sember issue of Discorder.
Welcome back to News 101 here on CITR 101.9 FM. To end our full hour of independent news, we shall go to Free Speech Radio for their international headlines.
I'm Nell Abram with FSRN Headlines.
Bahrain's highest court overturned the death sentences of two pro-democracy activists today and sent the cases back to the appellate court. The High Court ordered the same for another five people who'd been sentenced to life in prison. All were convicted of killing two police officers last spring. The decision came after a new witness emerged who says the charges were fabricated. In another retrial, dozens of medical professionals convicted of crimes against the state were back in civil court today. Their retrial came after independent investigators appointed by the king criticized the secret military court that initially convicted them. And over the weekend, Bahraini immigration officials turned Physicians for Human Rights leader Richard Salem away at the airport, saying NGO personnel need special permission to enter the country. Salem had planned to observe the medic's trial. Nigerian police killed at least three people today during nationwide protests that brought commercial activities to a standstill. Sam Olukoya reports from Lagos.
The smoke from bonfires blew across many Nigerian cities today as citizens expressed their anger at the government. The protesters were joined by professionals like lawyers, doctors, authors, leading musicians, and other celebrities. The January 1st removal of petroleum subsidies made the price of gasoline go up more than 100%, doubling from about the equivalent of 1.70 per gallon to more than $3.50. The fuel price jump has caused hardship for everyday Nigerians, most of whom live on less than $2 a day. The workers' union called the indefinite strike and protests that took hold in cities across the country, shuttering businesses and emptying the streets of all but protesters. The government says it must end the subsidies because it needs the money to develop infrastructures. But many Nigerians say official corruption is so rife that even if the government saves money from the subsidy removal, it is likely to be looted. Even though Nigeria is Africa's leading oil exporter, it imports gasoline because its refineries are not functional. The labor unions say the protests and strikes will continue until the government restores the subsidy. Sam Lukoya, FSRN, Lagos.
The FDA says that powerful painkillers packaged at a Lincoln, Nebraska pharmaceutical company may have made their way into the containers of other drugs. Opiates like Percodan and morphine sulfate were bottled by Novartis Consumer Health. The advisory was issued on the same day Novartis issued a voluntary recall of over-the-counter medications like Nodose and Excedrin, packaged at the same plant, warning that pills of one drug may have found their way into bottles of another. FDA spokesperson Shelley Burgess says the likelihood that the painkillers made their way into the over-the-counter medications is very low. However, the FDA has advised consumers and pharmacists to take precautionary measures.
We are asking pharmacists to perform a visual inspection when dispensing the potential affected endo-opioid medications according to instructions that we provided on our website. And those instructions simply ask pharmacists to visually inspect and verify the identity of all tablets dispensed.
More information on both the over-the-counter recall and the prescription drug advisory can be found at FDA.gov. U.S. Secretary of the Interior Ken Salazar announced a 20-year ban on new uranium or hard rock mines on more than 1 million acres of land adjacent to the Grand Canyon. Mines currently in operation and existing claims will not be affected by the ban. The move also does not affect all natural resource development. Mineral and geothermal leasing will still be allowed. There's been another massacre in Mexico, presumably related to fighting between criminal organizations. Shannon Young has more.
13 bodies were dumped early this morning at a gas station in Zitácuaro in the Pacific Coast state of Michoacán. Local media reports indicate the victims were all shot in the head and that three were minors. The state body responsible for murder investigations had not released a written press statement with further details as of deadline. The act of dumping multiple corpses in public spaces has increased in recent months. In at least two notable cases, the piles of bodies were accompanied by brazen messages from rival groups considered to be at a tactical disadvantage in the area where the bodies were left. The last double-digit body dump was on Christmas morning near Tampico, Tamaulipas, not far from the state line with Veracruz. The massacre also comes 1 week after the murder of 31 inmates at a Tamaulipas prison. Shannon Young, FSRN, Oaxaca.
Arizona Representative Gabrielle Giffords marked the one-year anniversary of the Tucson shooting in which six people died and a dozen people were injured, including the congresswoman. At a candlelight vigil Sunday evening, she led the crowd in the Pledge of Allegiance.
One nation under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Representative Giffords has served three terms in Congress. She's not yet decided if she will run for a fourth. The 23-year-old man facing 49 charges in the shooting, Jared Loughner, remains forcibly medicated in a Missouri prison. A report on his mental fitness for trial is due January 25th. For FSRN, from Tampa, Florida, I'm Nell Abram.
Thanks to Free Speech Radio for their international headlines. Their headlines and daily newscasts can be found at their website, fsrn.org.
And that's our program for January 9th. Today's newscast was brought to you entirely by volunteer efforts. If you'd like to share your comments, get involved with the show, give us an important news tip, please contact us through our email at news@citr.ca. You can subscribe to our podcast and listen to past shows at citr.ca. Or for more news, join us on Monday and Friday at 5 p.m. at another edition of News 101. I'm Martin Lemelin.
And I'm Chirag Mahajan. Today's show was produced by Claire Eagle from the entire news team at CITR. Thank you for listening. Stay tuned for Sore Throats Clapping Hands at 6 p.m. right here on CITR 101.9 FM.